This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. My name is Gikan, and I was asked to offer the talk today. Before I start, I just wanted to welcome all of you who are here for your first session. As I understand, there's quite a number of people here for their first session, so welcome. Welcome to this. I hope you're enjoying it so far. This is from a book called The Undying Lamp of Zen by the 18th century Rinzai teacher Torei Enji. Because I've had many illnesses, I am able to recognize others' illnesses. As I have cured my illnesses, I've learned about medicines. As my illnesses were gradually cured, I worried about others' illnesses. Because others had illnesses, my illness returned. I want to look at illness and medicine. About 9 months ago, I received a letter from one of the inmates I correspond with as part of our prison program, and I'll call him Leonard. And he wrote that his life had taken kind of a bad turn. Leonard and I are very close. We've been corresponding for almost 9 years right now, and I really do consider him to be a very dear friend of mine. And a chunk of time had elapsed, and I hadn't heard from him. And I get this letter, and he basically told me that he had been transferred to another correctional institution, and that it was very bad. He said that it was much rougher, much more aggressive, much more aggression. There's a lot more anger there. The noise, which he had always complained about in all of his institutions, was just unremitting here. It was just a very chaotic, noisy place. Leonard has a chronic medical condition, and in his former facility, they took that into account in terms of the work assignments he was given. In this new place, they aren't inclined to do that. So he really said that his body is really just being overtaxed. He said that, you know, he feels like, you know, someone just like beat the hell out of me each time he finishes work, right? And also, Leonard's a veteran, and in his former facility, he was in a dorm just for vets. And so he got some camaraderie and support and safety there. But in this new place, they have a vet dorm, but they're going to be shutting it down, and which means that he and the other vets will now be in general population. So his life took a bad turn, and of course that led to a lot of emotional upheaval for him. And in corresponding with Leonard over the last number of months, I really have found myself asking, what happens to us? And more personally, what happens to me when the things that maintain our happiness, our stability, and our well-being crumble? So, Torei Enji. As I mentioned, he's not part of our lineage. We don't chant his name. He's part of the Rinzai lineage. He was one of the key successors of Hakuin, great Rinzai teacher. And I turned to him. When writing to Leonard for these past months and to this book, The Undying Lamp of Zen, Leonard actually got a copy for himself because Torei's life is a very powerful teaching about all this. When he was in his 30s, he fell gravely sick. And as he says, the doctors pretty much gave up on him and told him he only had a few years left. And so he writes, at this point, I reflected that my life was not worth regretting. I only lamented the fact that I had not yet fulfilled my vow to help myself and help others, and had gone through all this hardship, his training with Hakuin, in vain. So most nights, the last words that we hear here in this Zendo and in the Brooklyn Zendo, and I imagine in most Zen training centers, is the evening gatha. Okay. In the silence, one person is chosen to recite the evening gatha, and essentially, you know, it's a reminder. It's a reminder that things are fragile, that we're fragile. Right? It reminds us that time swiftly passes, that opportunity is lost, and then it ends. You know, at times I hear the ending as a command, at times as a reminder, at times as a complete imperative. Do not squander your life. You know, I really get the feeling that at this point in his life, Toure was at that exact place that the Evening Gatha tries to bring us to, and he was there about as literally as a person can be there. Right? Literally, his time had nearly passed. Right? All of his opportunities that he might have had were dwindling, and by his reckoning, he had squandered his life. I had not yet fulfilled my vow. So what did he do? Sitting on a cushion, day and night with writing materials, I completed this manuscript, this book. After that, I sat and reclined at ease, leaving my life to fade. So at that place, he reclaimed his life. He fulfilled his vow in the way that he could, given where he was at that time. And as such, I think he's someone who I've turned to in terms of looking at this. Just a quick spoiler alert, he did actually survive his illness. And in doing so, after doing so, he was going to destroy his manuscript, but Hakuin actually read it and asked him, please not to do that. He said it could be of benefit. I think Hakuin said, if I recall correctly, it could be of benefit to beginners. So keep it around. He did. So that's why we have it. So in an early chapter of this book, Toure says the following. He says, great compassion is the foundation of Buddhahood. Observe people, how they ignore basics and pursue trivia, their greedy fixations and avaricious occupation, compulsively repeating all sorts of futile routines. Compare their state of mind with your own state of mind. So great compassion is the foundation, right? He begins by offering the medicine up front, and then he goes right to the disease, to the basic illness, as Buddhism understands the basic illness. And he first asks us, you know, look around, right? Look around us, look around you, just look around. Notice what's happening. You know, this is a call, as I see it, to pay attention. Don't just drift through your life. Right? Look around. See what is happening around you. And then turn the light around. Compare. Compare what you're seeing out there with what you're seeing in here. Right? And see what the relationship is. In another piece of writing, not in this book, in a letter he wrote, he kind of goes into this a little bit more. He says, in one day, a person wanders in the swamps of animal anxiety, ghostly greed and demonic wrath. Often they enter hellish ways, causing suffering. Truly, we should see how much we wander in the course of a day. So these states that he's describing, greed, compulsions, futile routines, anxiety, wrath, those are states that are termed the kleshas in Buddhism. And the kleshas are, interestingly enough, going with our little theme here, translated often as afflictions, or poisons, right? We've all heard of the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance. Those are considered to be the central kleshas. Kleshas or afflictions are mental states that cause us torment and that drive us to create torment. Okay. Now, you know, if you've read any amount of Buddhist literature, you've encountered passages like this, right? Where, I mean, this is in the sutras, it's in the later teachings, you know, about the Buddha or some other teacher talking about how we go through our day. And personally, it's easy for me to tune this out. Something about it is a little fire and brimstone for me. And I guess in general, I generally don't experience myself as afflicted like this. Right? So when I read this, I'm like, oh yeah, wow, it sucks for those people who are doing this. Right? So I guess the first thing that's really important for me as I was kind of working with this is he's actually talking about me. You know, this could be a totally ridiculous aside, but I'll say it anyway. I remember like years ago, I was in Florida on the beach, and I went into the water and I was swimming around, and I see a wallet floating in the water. And I'm just like, duh, some dumbass went into the water with his wallet. Now he's floating. And I realized, oh, this is my wallet, right? Story of my life in some ways. But, this is sort of what happens to me when I really work with teachings like this, right? It's like I'm looking at an x-ray or the results of a blood test that I think of for someone else. And then suddenly it dawns on me, well, wait a minute, no, this is my x-ray. Right? And I think in some ways this is what Toure and other teachers are driving at. No, this is not somebody else's life. This is your life. Right? And not because there's something personal about you, like personal about me. This is our lives. Therefore, it's your life. You need to pay attention to this. And the second thing that really strikes me when I work with this is Toure isn't describing some kind of extraordinary state of mind. He's talking about our normal. As he said, this is what happens in the course of a day. Right? When the teachings go into this, they really are talking about what most of us do much of the time. Our resting heartbeat, as it were, with regards to how we move through our life. So this is the mind of illness. Right? It's the mind that creates and is created by the afflictions. And, you know, being ill and being unaware of our illness, we in some ways have no choice but to create illness in the world. Right? That is kind of fundamentally what I think the teachings really point us to, right? To the extent that we are not aware of what our mind is doing, we will recreate that as we move through our day. And it's not hard to find that out there. And it really isn't. I actually came upon a couple of things that really brought this home to me. I don't know if some of you read this or not, but the United Nations released a report very recently where they talked about a scenario they called climate apartheid. And it's already happening. It's basically a situation where wealthy countries, wealthy hemispheres, and within that, wealthy people, wealthy individuals, can use their wealth to escape, as they say, overheating, hunger, and conflict, while the rest of the world is left to suffer. Right? And they sort of, and it's interesting, this wasn't a climate report. This was a human rights report, talking about the future of human rights. And they basically forecasted a world in which human rights essentially is impossible because of the scenario. Because as this climate apartheid continues, there will be a scenario in which the concentration of wealth and power is such that very few people who have a lot of wealth and a lot of power can pay to escape the climate suffering that will consume the vast majority of people. And the second piece of news, of course, is the horror show that's happening at our southern border, right? where children with brown skin, right, migrant children, are being caged. And I wrote down being caged in deplorable conditions, but not just deplorable, being caged in conditions that are traumatic and, given the deaths that have happened, that are murderous. Right? These two scenarios, right, when I was kind of looking at this, I began to realize that, the basic way that the teachings say that suffering happens is attraction and aversion. Holding on desperately to what we want and defending it at all costs, and getting rid of or expelling what we don't want. Right? So this really kind of shows that, right? We have a group of people that are paying huge amounts of money to hold on to a degree of security and comfort. And we have certain bodies of power in this country that are basically trying to cage what they don't want. And of course, it doesn't work. We don't need to be Buddhist necessarily to understand that, but Buddhism does say that this will not work. It's certainly not going to work for the wealthiest, whatever, 10%, 5%, 3%, 1%, 0.1% of the world, as the circle of climate comfort gets tighter and tighter, and as the price for that comfort increases. I don't know if any of you are Game of Thrones fans, But if you are, you will understand this in season six, when the army of the dead, when different groups were finding out about the army of, if you're not Game of Thrones fans, just I'm sure you can follow along. As different group societies were finding out about the army of the dead, there was the Ironborn, right, a warrior culture, and they were talking about how they're going to deal with the army of the dead. And one guy said, "Well, how about this? You know, they're a seafaring culture. Why don't we just go to an island, slaughter all the inhabitants, and just live on the island, and we'll be safe, right? And that'll be fine, you know." And when I was watching this, I'm like, well, first off, it wouldn't work because the Night King would just animate the dead that they slaughtered and they'd have an army of these out on the island, but that aside, I'm like, even if it did work, that's the kind of world that you would, I'm just trying to forecast this, what kind of world would that be? You've got your little island right here and just complete just like slaughter and devastation around you, and you've got your little island that you're hanging out in, you know, so even if it does work, it's not going to work. Not in any meaningful, habitable way. And it's not going to work at the border either, right? You know, I was thinking about this, and, you know, even if we make our border policies brutal enough, yes, it'll probably get to the point where no one wants to migrate here, but that brutality will live on, right? It will live on in our national karma, and the effects of that brutality will be far more nightmarish than any narrative that's being spun these days about what migrants are going to do to this country, right? So that won't work either. And bringing it closer to home, it doesn't work. Well, I'll be very personal. It didn't work for me. You know, throughout much of my life, I've struggled with depression. And you know, my way of dealing with this was exactly this. Trying desperately to hold on to states that were of relief, and trying hugely hard to get rid of the states that I didn't want. You know, I remember I was in a therapy group, and this young man came in, and he had a good week. Right? He wasn't depressed, he wasn't angry, he didn't F up at his job. It was a good week, and he was just saying, "I just have to hold on to this. You know, if I can just hold on to what I'm feeling this week, it'll be okay, right?" And we got it, right? And at the same time, we also knew that, you know, it wasn't going to happen, right? So why doesn't it work? Why doesn't this way of doing things work? It seems to make sense that it would work, but why doesn't it? I think it's because it doesn't work because reality doesn't work that way, right? And by reality, what I mean is just the things of the world and the things of our inner world, our experience, our feeling states. They don't work that way, right? Reality doesn't grab or defend anything, and reality doesn't reject or expel anything. I remember hearing and watching an interview with the environmental activist Julia Butterfly, and she was talking about garbage. And she said, you know, when we throw things away, where is away? Where do we imagine that we're throwing things away to? And where do we imagine this place is that they're gone forever and they will not bother us anymore? Right? The afflictions take us away. Right? When our mind is really just caught up in all these states that Torrey talks about, right, they take us away. They take us away from how things really are. You know, I was sort of thinking about this current debate around reparations. And, you know, there's one camp that basically says, you know, we don't need reparations, right, for African-American and indigenous people because that's in the past, right? That's already done. It's history, right? It's gone, right? That was way in the past. You know, it doesn't mean anything anymore. And this uprising... of voices, right? Black and indigenous voices, largely, that are saying, no, it's not in the past. It never went away, right? That is, there's such, in my opinion, might not be yours, but in my opinion, there is such understanding of reality behind that, right? These things don't go away. They've never gone away. Right? That's what they're in so many different ways. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, Angel Cuda. There's so many, you know, black thinkers and writers who are just trying to say that in so many ways that what we did doesn't go away. And in some ways, you know, it doesn't matter if it's the what we're expelling into the air, into the water, or the groups of cultures that we've expelled from power and from benefits. None of that went away. It never did. And we're now at a point where we can't ignore that anymore. So practice is about not ignoring that. Right? Practice, in a very basic level, brings attention to this mind as it cranks through all of that. You know, sometimes during open sozan at the end of sesshin, people talk about how sesshin really feels like coming home. Right? And I think this is sort of maybe underlying that. You know, what is home? Home is where you're not away. Right? You go away and then you come home. Right? Home is a place where you're not away anymore. And I think, you know, it really, you know, sesshin especially, this kind of container, this spaciousness of time and silence, is really allows us to come home in the sense that, you know, we can see everything that we've thought was away and how our mind has been doing that. In beginning instruction, when we give that very basic instruction, see the thought, what essentially that means is pay attention to the illness. Right? Pay attention, and the illness isn't the thought. Right? The thought is just a thought. The illness happens with what we do to the thought. Right, so think of it. So that's essentially what this is. You know, see the thought is pay attention. Pay attention to what you're doing with your mind. Shortly after I began Zen practice, you know, I sort of entered Zen practice in a period of pretty painful depression, and I found this book. It's a pretty good book. It's called A Zen Path Through Depression. It's written by a guy, Phil Martin. He's not a teacher. He's a practitioner, social worker, depression survivor. And in his book, in the beginning, you know, he gives like a basic meditation instruction. And then he says, sit, you know, really ground yourself, follow your breath. And then he says, you know, welcome your feelings of fear, your pain, your depression into this place. And I tell the depression that it need not feel excluded from this place, that it will receive understanding and compassion, right? And I actually did this. You know, I actually began to really work with this and try to do this. And it was radically different than other ways that I had been trying to work with my depression. You know, because, you know, everything that I was trying to keep and control, everything, parts of my experience that I was trying to push away, that I was trying to cage, right? Because I didn't want them anymore. Other parts that I wanted to hold on to. This just said, just bring it all in. Right? And you know, there's this kind of place where, you know, you're sort of like, you know, can I do this? Right? Can I actually do this? Right? And I think, you know, our teachers have a confidence that yes, we can. We can do this. Right? If for no other reason than that everything else that we've tried, or everything else that I tried, just didn't work. Right? I remember when I got beginning instruction in New York City, before we had the Brooklyn Temple, we had a loft space in Chelsea, so like on the 10th floor of this big office building. And I remember going there for beginning instruction, and I sort of stopped. I got there very early, just like my neurotic self. And I stopped, and I just walked around the block a few times. You know, looking back, it's almost weird. I was almost like circumambulating the zendo a few times. And I kept asking myself, am I ready to do this? You know, because I said, nothing else has worked. You know, I was doing good things. I was in therapy. I was in grad school studying social work, which I really, really liked a lot. I was taking up a writing practice, you know, poetry. I was doing the right things. And it was helping, but none of it was really hitting it. And I asked myself, you know, am I ready to take this chance? Because if this doesn't work, I didn't know much about Buddhism, but I sort of felt like, you know, if this doesn't work, then it's like I got nothing. Right? This sort of has to work, right? Because nothing else has, and I don't know what else there could possibly be. And you know, I went in, and I was really pleased to see that yes, know, this way of working with experience, with reality, you know, it's doable, right? And it helps. The teacher, Zenju Earthlin Manuel, put a Facebook post up a couple of days ago about the issue, the caging of migrant children. And she says about this, she goes, "We have to stop and take a look into the shadow of our human beingness, take it by the hand, and see what it is trying to tell us about us as a collective society. All of what is happening here and there is about us." And she really takes this and she kind of just blows it up, but it's the same thing, right? How do we work with a national culture, whether or not we feel we're a part of it, with a national culture that has led up to this, with a historical culture that has led up to this? We take it by the hand, right? We don't commit violence to it as a response to violence, because then we're not going to understand anything. We take it by the hand and we see what it is trying to tell us. And from there, we can move from that place of understanding to changing, right? To making the changes, to making the advocacy that we need to do. You know, this is the nice thing about practice, is that nothing is thrown away in this practice, right? Not a thing. Every piece of yourself, every piece of your experience is your experience. And practice is spacious enough to hold all of that. So what kind of practice is this, right? In a later chapter, Toure says the following about practicing in this way, right? He says, "The ignorant practice while ignorant. The stubborn practice while stubborn. Those with lesser faculties practice with lesser faculties. Those with many illnesses practice with many illnesses. The young practice while young. The old practice while old. Success is considered success. Failure is considered failure. Attainment is considered attainment. Not yet having attained is considered not yet having attained. Nothing is covered up." I love this. I just love it. Okay? I mean, I'm really putting myself into his place, right? With his time running out, really just haunted by the possibility that he may have wasted his life, he pulls out of himself this vision of practice and of life that is completely honest and completely redemptive, no matter who we are, no matter what our afflictions are. Practice is nothing covered up. It's the medicine of facing all of us, whether that all is in the skin bag or outside the skin bag. And over time, you know, that's from my experiences, that's what I've noticed. To the extent that I can notice myself in practice, that's what I've noticed. Two very quick incidents. A number of years ago, I actually fainted in the Zendo. And it wasn't one of these very subtle faints. It was at the end of the evening, we were all standing up, and I just took a dive. And I have no idea how I did this, but I was on that side of the Zendo. And when the monitor came to revive me, I was on that side of the Zendo. Yeah, I have no idea. It must have been quite a performance. I have no idea how on earth that could have happened. So, you know, he takes me out, and I'm sitting on the bench, and Shugen comes over and asks me how I'm doing. And I said, I have no idea what happened. And he said, "You just fainted." You know, it took me a while to take that in. But he was wrong. I didn't just faint. I fainted, and a whole bag of crap came along with that. Oh, my God, I just made like an asshole of myself in front of the entire Sangha. Boy, they must think I'm a loser. This is like, how do I make up for this? Jeez, what's going to happen? It was anything but just fainting, right? I didn't want that experience. I really did not want to have that. I didn't want that experience. I wanted to just kind of carve it out and just chuck it someplace else. And so much of like, the next couple of days was all sorts of machinations to try to do that, right? Didn't work. I still fainted. So fast forward, as many of the the newer people here would know, I was asked to teach people how to tie the Oryoki knot, and I 100% botched it completely. I will own this. I sat everyone down, we were doing, and as soon as I got the thing covered up, my mind completely froze. I had no idea how to tie that knot. And I'm sitting in there, and I'm trying. It just wasn't working. You know, and of course, I've got like all these people who are doing this for the first time who are looking to me to help them to do this. And I'm just like, you kind of been doing this for almost 20 years. You can do this. And I'm trying to do this. And it was perfectly okay. It was okay. You know, it was fine. There wasn't any residue, right? It worked. I mean, essentially what happens is that all the newcomers taught me how to tie my Oryoki knot. I mean, in the end, that's basically what happened. And, you know, we worked it out. And we worked it out, right? You know, it's those little changes like that. You know, it's when my friend Leonard writes to me recently, and he said that, you know, in the past, this kind of upheaval would have spun him into depression, which is something he also struggles with. But he says, you know, so far, I've been watching it all play out in a more or less calm manner. I'm viewing it all with detached awareness, and when it seems to be too much, I simply view that the same way. Right? It's that same thing. Having corresponded with him for this long, I know what even minor things would have done to him in the past. Right? He would just write to me that he's completely depressed. Right, and he's nothing is hopeful, nothing has a point to it. And the fact that he can go through this and really say this, right? He's not doing it perfectly, but you know, he's able to now take in this experience without any need to do anything to it, while at the same time advocating for himself within it. So because I've had many illnesses, I'm able to recognize others' illnesses. As I have cured my illnesses, I've learned about medicines. As my illnesses were gradually cured, I worried about others' illnesses. Because others had illnesses, my illness returned. To the extent that I understand any of this, this is probably the most concise and the most accurate description of Mahayana Buddhism that I've encountered, right? The way of the Bodhisattva. Our suffering, our illnesses, is exactly what allows us to be there for others, to be there for the suffering of others. Right? So I don't know why I just put that away. I wanted to refer back to it. It's what Shunryu Suzuki said, meant when he said, your very imperfections will form the basis of your way-seeking mind. That's one of the first things I read when I started Zen practice, and I just like imprinted it on my head, basically. Right? Those things that we dislike the most about our illnesses are exactly what will allow us to help others. And as we, I'm not going to use the word cure, but as we clarify our illnesses, as we bring clarity to it, we learn how to bring clarity to it. We learn, right? And as we get clear, slowly, right, to the extent that we get clear, we can see other people's afflictions clearly. And when we see other people's afflictions, we know that we will never be free of afflictions until they are. So I wanted to end with just a really brief quote here. I work in the mental health field, and I occasionally will get things like this. I got this posting for this job training program for people who have a serious and persistent mental illness. Essentially, it's a program where they train them to become peers, which is people who have had lived experience with mental illness who now get training in order to be coaches, you know, and supports for other people. And so they had blurbs from people, you know, who've done this, and just want to read this. This guy, Frank, had to say. He says, my dream is to have peace and contentment, and my way to do that is to help people like myself. So in some form or another, I'm going to have a pretty much regular job helping people, which ain't going to get me rich, but it's going to fulfill the heart. Yeah, exactly. I have no idea who Frank is. I don't know if he's Buddhist, and you know, it really doesn't matter. Buddhism doesn't own this medicine. You know, we're not big pharma. We didn't like patent this, right? It doesn't belong to us, right? This is, I think, what naturally happens when someone, us, my friend Leonard, this gentleman Frank, Torre, when they look at what's happening inside. And I'm not going to use the word cure, but when they come to terms with it, when they learn how to work with it, when they learn to completely not, attack certain parts of themselves, not to grab on and hold on to other, when they really learn how to work with what's happening inside, this is exactly what happens. And I love the way he says it. I'm going to have a pretty much regular job helping people. It's going to fulfill the heart. It's not a big deal. Maybe that's the real lesson here, is that what happens is not a big deal, and this is how it happens. It's a very much a regular thing. That what Torre said, you know, what we do in the course of the day, it might start as affliction, but as we practice, what we do in the course of a day really does become exactly that, helping other people and fulfilling the heart. So let's cultivate this medicine. Let's cultivate it and let's offer it to our very personal illnesses and to the illnesses of all others. Thank you for your attention, everyone.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.